Chapter 13. In which Mr. Walker falls into difficulties and misses. Walker makes many foolish attempts to rescue him. I hope the beloved reader is not silly enough to imagine that Mr. Walker, on finding himself ensconced for dead in Chancery Lane, was so foolish as to think of applying to any of his friends, those great personages who have appeared every now and then in the course of this little history, and have served to give it a fashionable air. No, no, he knew the world too well, and that, though Billingsgate would give him as many dozen of claret as he could carry away under his belt, as the phrase is, I can't help it, madam, if the phrase is not more genteel, and though Vauxhall would lend him his carriage, slap him on the back, and dine at his house, their lordships would have seen Mr. Walker depending from a beam in front of the Old Bailey, rather than have helped him to £100. And why, forsooth, should we expect otherwise in the world? I observe that men who complain of its selfishness are quite as selfish as the world is, and no more liberal of money than their neighbors. And I am quite sure with regard to Captain Walker, that he would have treated a friend in want exactly as he, when in want, was treated. There was only his lady who was in the least afflicted by his captivity. And as for the club that went on, we are bound to say, exactly as it did on the day previous to his disappearance. By the way, about clubs, could we not, but for fear of detaining the fair reader too long, enter into a wholesome dissertation here on the manner of friendship established in those institutions, and the noble feeling of selfishness which they are likely to encourage in the male race? I put out of the question the stale topics of complaint, such as leaving home, encouraging gormandizing and luxurious habits, etc. Semicolon, but look also at the dealings of club men with one another. Look at the rush for the evening paper. See how Shiverton orders a fire in the dog days, and Swettenham opens the windows in February. See how Cramley takes the whole breast of the turkey on his plate, and how many times Jenkins sends away his beggarly half-pint of sherry. Clubbery is organized egotism. Club intimacy is carefully and wonderfully removed from friendship. You meet Smith for 20 years, exchange the day's news with him, laugh with him over the last joke, grow as well acquainted as two men may be together, and one day, at the end of the list of members of the club, you read in a little paragraph by itself, with all the honors, member deceased. Smith, John Esquire, semicolon, he, on the other hand, has the advantage of reading your own name selected for a similar typographical distinction. There it is, that abominable little exclusive list at the end of every club catalogue. You can't avoid it. I belong to 8 clubs myself, and know that one year Fitzpoodle, George Savage Esquire, unless it should please fate, to remove my brother and his 6 sons, when of course it would be Fitzpoodle, Sir George Savage, Bart. Comma will appear in the dismal category. There is that list. Down I must go in it. The day will come, and I shan't be seen in the bow window, someone else will be sitting in the vacant armchair. The rubber will begin as usual, and yet somehow Fitz will not be there. Where's Fitz? Says Trumpington, just arrived from the Rhine. Don't you know? Says Punter, turning down his thumb to the carpet. You led the club, I think? Says Ruff to his partner, the other partner. Comma, and the waiter snuffs the candles. Asterisk, 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 I hope in the course of the above little pause, every single member of a club who reads this has profited by the perusal. He may belong, I say, to 8 clubs. He will die, and not be missed by any of the 5,000 members. Peace be to him. The waiters will forget him, and his name will pass away, and another great coat will hang on the hook, whence his own used to be dependent. And this, I need not say, is the beauty of the club institutions. If it were otherwise, if, forsooth, we were to be sorry when our friends died, or to draw out our purses when our friends were in want, we should be insolvent, and life would be miserable. Be it ours to button up our pockets and our hearts, and to make merry, it is enough to swim down this life stream for ourselves. If poverty is clutching hold of our heels, or friendship would catch an arm, kick them both off. Every man for himself, is the word, and plenty to do too. My friend Captain Walker had practiced the above maxim so long and resolutely as to be quite aware, when he came himself to be in distress, that not a single soul in the whole universe would help him, and he took his measures accordingly. When carried to Mr. Bendigo's lock-up house, he summoned that gentleman in a very haughty way, took a blank banker's check out of his pocketbook, and filling it up for the exact sum of the writ, orders Mr. Bendigo forthwith to open the door, and let him go forth. Mr. Bendigo, smiling with exceeding archness, and putting a finger covered all over with diamond rings to his extremely aquiline nose, inquired of Mr. Walker whether he saw anything green about his face, intimating by this gay and good-humored interrogatory his suspicion of the unsatisfactory nature of the document handed over to him by Mr. Walker. "Hang it, sir," says Mr. Walker, "go and get the check cashed, and be quick about it. Send your man in a cab, and here's a half-crown to pay for it." The confident air somewhat staggers the bailiff, who asked him whether he would like any refreshment, while his man was absent getting the amount of the check, and treated his prisoner with great civility during the time of the messenger's journey. But as Captain Walker had but a balance of £2.5 and 2p, this sum was afterwards divided among his creditors, the law expenses being previously deducted from it. The bankers of course declined to cash the captain's draft for £200 and odd, simply writing the words "O effects" on the paper, on receiving which reply Walker, far from being cast down, burst out laughing very gaily, produced a real £5 note, and called upon his host for a bottle of champagne, which the two worthies drank in perfect friendship and good humor. The bottle was scarcely finished, and the young Israelitish gentleman who acts as waiter in Cursitor Street had only time to remove the flask and the glasses, when poor Morgina, with a flood of tears, rushed into her husband's arms, and flung herself on his neck, and calling him her dearest, blessed Howard, would have fainted at his feet, but that he, breaking out in a fury of oaths, asked her how, after getting him into that scrape through her infernal extravagance, she dared to show her face before him. This address speedily frightened the poor thing out of her fainting fit. There is nothing so good for female hysterics as a little conjugal sternness, nay, brutality, as many husbands can aver who are in the habit of employing the remedy. "My extravagance, Howard?" said she, in a faint way, and quite put off her purpose of swooning by the sudden attack made upon her. "Surely, my love, you have nothing to complain of, ma'am," roared the excellent Walker. "S200 guineas to a music master, nothing to complain of? Did you bring me such a fortune as to authorize your taking guinea lessons? Haven't I raised you out of your sphere of life, and introduced you to the best of the land? Haven't I dressed you like a duchess? Haven't I been for you such a husband as very few women in the world ever had, madam? Answer me that." "Indeed, Howard, you were always very kind," sobbed the lady. "Haven't I toiled and slaved for you, been out all day working for you? Haven't I allowed your vulgar old mother to come to your house, to my house, I say? Haven't I done all this?" She could not deny it, and Walker, who was in a rage, and when a man is in a rage, for what on earth is a wife made, but that he should vent his rage on her? Comma continued for some time in this strain, and so abused, frightened, and overcame poor Morgina, that she left her husband fully convinced that she was the most guilty of beings, and bemoaning his double bad fortune, that her Howard was ruined, and she the cause of his misfortunes. When she was gone, Mr. Walker resumed his equanimity, for he was not one of those men whom a few months of the King's Bench were likely to terrify, and drank several glasses of punch in company with his host, with whom in perfect calmness he talked over his affairs. That he intended to pay his debt and quit the sponging house next day is a matter of course, No one ever was yet put in a sponging house that did not pledge his veracity. He intended to quit it tomorrow. Mr. Bendigo said he should be heartily glad to open the door to him, and in the meantime sent out diligently to see among his friends if there were any more detainers against the captain, and to inform the captain's creditors to come forward against him. Morgina went home in profound grief, it may be imagined, and could hardly refrain from bursting into tears when the sugar loaf page asked whether Master was coming home early or whether he had taken his key. She lay awake tossing and wretched the whole night, and very early in the morning rose up and dressed and went out. Before 9 o'clock she was in Cursitor Street, and once more joyfully bounced into her husband's arms, who woke up yawning and swearing somewhat, with a severe headache, occasioned by the jollification of the previous night. For, strange though it may seem, there are perhaps no places in Europe where jollity is more practiced than in prisons for debt, and I declare for my own part, I mean, of course, that I went to visit a friend. I have dined at Mr. Aminadab's as sumptuously as it longs. But it is necessary to account for Morgina's joyfulness, which was strange in her husband's perplexity, and after her sorrow of the previous night. Well, then, when Mrs. Walker went out in the morning, she did so with a very large basket under her arm. "All I carry the basket, ma'am," said the page, seizing it with much alacrity. "No, thank you," cried his mistress, with equal eagerness. "Tease only, of course, ma'am," replied the boy, sneering, "I knew it was that." "Glass," continued Mrs. Walker, turning extremely red. "Ave the goodness to call a coach, sir, and not to speak till you are questioned." The young gentleman disappeared upon his errand. The coach was called and came. Mrs. Walker slipped into it with her basket, and the page went downstairs to his companions in the kitchen, and said, "It's a comin'. Master's in quad, and Miss Suss has gone out to pawn the plate." When the cook went out that day, she somehow had by mistake placed in her basket a dozen of table knives and a plated egg stand. When the lady's maid took a walk in the course of the afternoon, she found that he had occasion for 8 cambric pocket handkerchiefs, marked with her mistress's cipher, half a dozen pair of shoes, gloves, long and short, some silk stockings, and a gold-headed scent bottle. "Off the new cashmere's is gone," said she, "and there's nothing left in Mrs. Walker's trinket box but a paper of pins and an old coral bracelet." As for the page, he rushed incontinently to his master's dressing room, and examined every one of the pockets of his clothes, made a parcel of some of them, and opened all the drawers which Walker had not locked before his departure. He only found 3 halfpence and a bill stamp, and about 45 tradesmen's accounts, neatly labeled and tied up with red tape. These 3 worthies, a groom who was a great admirer of Trimmer the lady's maid, and a policeman a friend of the cook's, sat down to a comfortable dinner at the usual hour, and it was agreed among them all that Walker's ruin was certain. The cook made the policeman a present of a china punch bowl which Mrs. Walker had given her, and the lady's maid gave her friend the Book of Beauty for last year, and the 3rd volume of Byron's poems from the drawing room table. "I'm dashed if she ain't taken the little French clock too," said the page, and so indeed Mrs. Walker had. It slipped in the basket, where it lay enveloped in one of her shawls, and then struck madly and unnaturally a great number of times, as Morgina was lifting her store of treasures out of the hackney coach. The coachman wagged his head sadly as he saw her walking as quick as she could under her heavy load, and disappearing round the corner of the street at which Mr. Ball's celebrated jewelry establishment is situated. It is a grand shop, with magnificent silver cups and salvers, rare gold-headed canes, flutes, watches, diamond brooches, and a few fine specimens of the old masters in the window, and under the words, "Balls, jeweler, you read, money lent," in the very smallest type, on the door. The interview with Mr. Balls need not be described, but it must have been a satisfactory one, therefore at the end of half an hour Morgana returned and bounded into the coach with sparkling eyes, and told the driver to gallop to Cursitor Street, which, smiling, he promised to do, and accordingly set off in that direction at the rate of 4 miles an hour. "Thought so," said the philosophic charioteer. "When a man's in quad, a woman don't mind her silver spoons," and he was so delighted with her action that he forgot to grumble when she came to settle accounts with him, even though she gave him only double his fare. "Take me to him," said she to the young Hebrew who opened the door. "To whom?" says the sarcastic youth. "There's 20 hymns here. You're precious early." "To Captain Walker, young man," replied Morgana haughtily. Whereupon the youth, opening the second door, and seeing Mr. Bendigo in a flowered dressing gown descending the stairs, exclaimed, "Papa, here's a lady for the captain." "I'm come to free him," said she, trembling, and holding out a bundle of banknotes. "Here's the amount of your claim, sir, 220 guineas, as you told me last night." The Jew took the notes, and grinned as he looked at her, and grinned double as he looked at his son, and begged Mrs. Walker to step into his study and take a receipt. When the door of that apartment closed upon the lady and his father, Mr. Bendigo the younger fell back in an agony of laughter, which it is impossible to describe in words, and presently ran out into a court, where some of the luckless inmates of the house were already taking the air, and communicated something to them which made those individuals also laugh as uproariously as he had previously done. Well, after joyfully taking the receipt from Mr. Bendigo, how her cheeks flushed and her heart fluttered as she dried it on the blotting book. Comma, and after turning very pale again on hearing that the captain had had a very bad night. "And well he might, poor dear," said she, at which Mr. Bendigo, having no person to grin at, grinned at a marble bust of Mr. Pitt, which ornamented his sideboard. Morgana, I say, these preliminaries being concluded, was conducted to her husband's apartment, and once more flinging her arms round her dearest Howard's neck, told him with one of the sweetest smiles in the world to make haste, and get up and come home, for breakfast was waiting, and the carriage at the door. "What do you mean, love?" said the captain, starting up and looking exceedingly surprised. "I mean that my dearest is free, that the odious little creature is paid at least the horrid bailiff is." "Have you been to Borowski?" said Walker, turning very red. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.